okay, this is the 9/11 Truth Teleconference for 24th of February 2016. Kent Reel is facilitating, Craig Key scribing, and we're ready to get started. Craig, would you like to call the roll?
Okay, I've noted down 12 names, so we'll see if I've missed anybody. David Cole, Ken Freeland, Craig McKee, John O'Malley, Robin Horton, Dwayne Beach, Barbara Honegger, Cheryl Curtis, Richard Sachs, Ned Delaney, Tim Michael, and Clay Caldwell. Did I get everyone?
Dan Tennant, AE 911.
Okay, right. Thank you, Dan.
And Wayne Huss. Kat McGuire.
Sorry. Oh, Kat McGuire. Okay, so we got more. Okay, great.
Oh, hi, Kat.
Hey, Barbara. Hi.
Look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah.
Could I just ask Clay, it's Clay, C-L-A-Y?
Correct.
And do you have a particular group affiliation that you would like noted in the minutes, or?
No, I don't.
Just 9/11 activist would be all right for you?
That would be fine.
Or would that work? Okay, good. Great, thank you.
Clay, could you give me
From what city, Clay? What city are you active in?
Well, I'm not really active. I'm interested. I'm in Pennsylvania.
Okay. Well, there should be some other folks that are... Okay. Okay, so that's David Schlesinger and Xander, X-A-N-D-E-R, Arena, A-R-E-N-A, and Xander, your affiliation is what again?
With Arizona Studies and Outreach, 9/11 Studies and Outreach.
Thank you.
At ASU, Arizona State University.
Thank you. Okay, so but there are still a couple of people who haven't given their identities yet, so... We need to recheck this, Craig. I'm sorry, but there's a couple more people on the line that than have owned up to being here. So if you could go through the list again, and I'll count as you go, and we'll see who's not showing up. Okay.
Okay. Sure. David Cole, Ken Freeland, Craig McKee, John O'Malley, Robin Horton, Dwayne Dietz, Dan Hennen, Dave Schlesinger, Barbara Honegger, Cheryl Curtis, Richard Sachs, Ned Delaney, Tim Michael, Clay Caldwell, Kat McGuire, Xander Arena, and that's all I have.
And as a presenter, my name's Ed Haslam, and so...
Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Ed, we'll be getting started. We're just getting started here, but unfortunately, there's still one more person who's not identifying himself or herself as being on the call. Can that one person please tell us who they are so that we can get proceed?
Yeah, Craig, can you hear me? This is Wayne.
Ah, there we go.
Oh, yes, sorry. Yes, no, I did not hear you before. Okay.
Yeah, there we
sorry.
Go. Okay.
Yeah.
We're good to go then. So we have our roll call finished, and we're ready to move on to the approval of the previous minutes. I see, Craig, there was one exception, I guess, one amendment to that I forwarded to you, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
so,
there is, and I can't remember off the top of my head what it was, but yes.
Well, that's okay. As long as we know what it is, but it's somebody who was on the call. It was Adam Ruff. Adam Ruff was on
Adam
the call.
Yeah. How I missed Adam Ruff, I don't know.
Incredible. Your own partner. Your own partner in the debate. You missed
too
him.
Close.
Okay.
Too close.
Yeah. So anyway, with that amendment, are there any other amendments to the minutes from last week? Or let's look. If not, then we'll take the minutes for approved and move on to tonight's draft agenda. Are there any amendments or changes to the agenda proposed to the draft agenda? Hearing none, that I need to mention that AE 9/11 Truth, being aware that Dave Schlesinger wished to make a comment about their policy, requested equal time, and Andy Steele would like to make a response after Dave makes his comment later in the broadcast, or in the podcast. So if there's no objection, we'll give him equal time to respond to Dave's concerns, okay?
I object that he gets to say, speak after me, and I don't get to speak after him. I'd rather be able to have it be 2.5, 2.5, 2.5, 2.5.
I don't think that's the way that they requested to do it either, so what
I'm
we'll
sure.
have to do here is...
They don't want to have to...
not at this time. Yeah. I don't think it's that, Dave. I think they just preferred to make their own statement, just for the record, rather than get into a debate with you. So, what I'd like to do then is just take a vote as to whether or not this item should be included in the agenda or not. Does anybody else wish to speak for or against the motion to include a response from AE 911 Truth?
Craig.
Craig, okay.
Yeah, I would say that yes, I would be definitely in favor of it, particularly given the subject matter, and also I think that it's perfectly reasonable that AE should respond to Dave's statement. And if people want to ask questions after, they can do it.
Yeah. Okay. If there are no more responses, then we'll just take a voice vote. If you say yes, you're in favor of allowing AE 911 Truth to be included in the agenda for a brief response to David's concerns in the agenda later on. If not, then you're opposed. If you say no, you're opposed to that idea. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, say no. Okay, so we will then give them equal time to respond to David's concern later, and we will now proceed with the agenda as it went out in the draft.
Yes. Ken, it's Barb. It's a point of order. I didn't get the agenda. Did you email it right away?
Yeah, everybody got it. It was sent out to the entire list, yeah.
Did you send it to 911telecon at yahoogroup.com?
I couldn't tell you, Barbara. It goes out to the same invitation list every month.
Okay, I don't have it from either that or from Diogenes, so I would appreciate being able to read it.
Well, there's nothing I knew about at the moment. I'm sorry.
Well, maybe you could just read the agenda for those of us. Barbara, I'll send it to you. Are you on email? I'll send it to you.
Thank you, Cheryl. I appreciate it. Okay.
Thank you.
I'm a little too concerned to be able to do that at the moment. Okay. So, one moment here. Okay, so our first item on the agenda is our guest of honor this evening. We're very honored to have with us Ed Haslam, who is an author of great renown in the JFK genre. And here to introduce him is the woman who did the footwork to get him involved in our teleconference, and that would be Kat McGuire. Kat?
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Hi. Ed Haslam today lives in Florida, but he grew up in New Orleans in the 50s, where his father taught at Tulane Medical School and was a colleague of Dr. Mary Sherman. Ed remembers as a child sitting on Dr. Mary's lap, and he personally heard and saw things that most of the public is completely unaware of, including grisly details of Dr. Mary's macabre murder. In some ways, Ed's background reminds me of Peter Janney. Peter Janney is a JFK researcher whose father was in the CIA during the assassination period. And Danny, by the way, has his own Mary book called Mary's Mosaic, which is also about the JFK assassination. Both Ed and Danny's books are personal accounts that interweave family history with captivating details that outside researchers are just not in a position to match for the historical record. Unfortunately, neither Ed nor Peter Janney have been that well received by the established JFK research community. In Ed's case, Dr. Mary's Monkey is such a seemingly outlandish tale that on some level it is understandable that JFK researchers, who are marginalized and always struggling to establish their credibility, why they would shy away from such a sprawling, jaw-dropping story. Dr. Mary's monkeys go way beyond the parameters of the Kennedy assassination, including the shocking cover-up of a monkey virus that contaminated polio vaccines in the 50s and might well be the cause of our current cancer epidemic. To the JFK research community, Ed's book probably seems convoluted, if not threatening to their legitimacy. Ed is not a professional JFK researcher or medical expert. He does not claim to present a final accounting of what took place in New Orleans that summer of 1963. And he actively requests other researchers to please pick up the ball and run with his lead. Further hindering the book's acceptance, though, is Ed's recognition of Judith Vary Baker, a controversial figure who at that time was a cancer researcher for Dr. Mary, as supposedly were Lee Harvey Oswald and David Vary. Among Baker's claims is that she and Oswald fell deeply in love. Black Ops Radio, a premier outlet for JFK research, is highly distrustful of Baker's version of events. And unfortunately, as a result, Dr. Mary's monkey has gotten somewhat tainted by association. I read Ed's book a while back and was deeply intrigued. Last October, I went to a Lee Harvey Oswald conference in New Orleans, in large part specifically to hear Ed speak and determine his authenticity for myself. I came away believing Ed has a lot of valuable information to share and that the establishment JFK community needs to be encouraged to investigate Ed's startling discovery. It is not right that so many of the researchers have dismissed his book just because it doesn't fall within their narrative boundaries. Bringing Ed here tonight to speak to you is my effort to try to get the word out that this book needs to be taken seriously. I hope after hearing Ed's presentation, you will agree and do whatever you can to help get Dr. Mary's monkey the broader exposure it deserves. Thank you.
Thank you, Kat. Mr. Heflin,
yep.
Your show is yours. Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let me begin just by reading the title of the book and the subtitle so you get, because it kind of paints the broad brush landscape of what I'm going to be talking about. Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and Cancer-Causing Monkey Viruses are linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK assassination, and emerging global epidemics. Sounds a little bit like a warning label. Now, I want to secondly address the point that Kat was making, and I think there's a fair amount of substance in what she was saying about the resistance of the JFK community to this, but, you know, frankly, I really don't give a hoot about that. My book outsells all those guys' books, okay? I've got 432 reviews on Amazon, and I've got, you know, just a 4.5-star rating. I've been very well accepted by lots of people. There's a handful of holdouts, but you can't live your life around them. The other thing about Judith Vary Baker is I wound up bringing Judith Vary Baker's book, which is now called Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald. I brought it to my publisher, Trine Day, and got them to agree to publish it, but they did so on the condition that I personally would do the first draft edit on it. And that's because I'm from New Orleans, and I know the places and the people involved. And so that's how all this stuff pulls together. Now, I want to go on to the point about you all being an organization which calls itself 9/11 Truth and Deep State Crimes. I think it's awesome that you include deep state crimes in with 9/11, because this show's been going on for a long time, and 9/11 is just the peak of the iceberg on it. And what Kat was talking about with people with narrative boundaries and stuff like that, I think we, you know, at times we got to look at the detail, but all other times we got to sit back and look at the broad brush. Now, let me just quickly tell you what this book is about, and then I'm going to get into the deep state crimes really big time here. Mary Sherman was a doctor in New Orleans. She taught orthopedic surgery at Tulane Medical School, which at the time was one of the premier medical schools in the country. And she was out of the University of Chicago, where she was personal friends with Enrico Fermi, Harold Urey, people like that. I mean, these are the guys that invented the atomic bomb, okay? And she was an expert in radiation. She's published in all these peer-reviewed articles. She's quoted 50 years after her death in these articles. And she was an expert in cancer. She ran a cancer laboratory for Dr. Alton Ochsner in New Orleans, which is Ochsner Clinic. It's one of the big regional medical clinics. And Ochsner himself was president of the American Cancer Society. Okay? So we've got radiation, cancer, murder. And then in the 1960s, remember, I'm from New Orleans. I was in high school in the 1960s. The big event in town was that Jim Garrison was doing his JFK assassination investigation, which is the subject of Oliver Stone's JFK movie. Well, because I was there and where I was positioned in town, I mean, my father was the president of a hospital and a faculty member at Tulane. He taught the same subject, orthopedic surgery, with Mary Sherman. Okay, they were good friends, right? Mary would come out to the house and stuff, and as Kat mentioned, I even sat on her lap once as a child. But the point is, she was a world-class expert, and my father was out of Harvard Medical School. I mean, he was no slouch either, okay? And my father, who had gone through the Navy and World War II and all this other stuff, had, like, the utmost respect for Mary Sherman, okay? I mean, professional respect. He just thought she was at the top of the ladder. And the top of the ladder, by the way, in orthopedic surgery is the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, where Mary Sherman was the chair of the pathology committee, okay? That made her one of the highest-ranking women in American medicine, okay? So what happens here in 1964 is we, there's a phone call to the police that said, we've got smoke coming out of somebody's apartment. The police show up, and they can't get in. They call the fire department, and there is a body in this apartment. Well, it's her apartment. It's her body, you know, and the place is full of smoke. So they finally clear it out, and they go in there, and they look, and they discover her body on the floor. The firemen have taken the mattress out, so it probably rolled off there. And the point is, her entire right arm and ribcage has been disintegrated by heat. Disintegrated. That takes thousands of degrees of heat. But there's no fire damage in the apartment. The books on the nightstand are not burned. The curtains next to the bed is not burned. The carpet's not burned. And 25% of her body, her entire right arm, up to her shoulder and down through her ribcage to her hip, is missing, is carbonized. And right next to that is unburned hair. All right, so we got a forensic problem here. Is that hair is the easiest thing to burn on your body. And her hair's not burned. But bones technically don't even burn. Even in a formal cremation, which is about 2 hours at about 1,600 degrees, that burns off the soft tissue. And when you're left, there are bones. And they grind up the bones and say, you know, here's your dust-to-dust back. The point is, when you go through this forensically and think it through, you have to ask a logical question, and that's what I do throughout this whole thing. Is I suffer from insatiable curiosity, so I just keep asking the logical question. And the first logical question is, what burned off Mary Sherman's arm? The toaster? I mean, the problem is that there's absolutely nothing in her apartment, and it's a wood frame building, and there's only a little 13 apartments. There's nothing in her apartment that could physically have burned off her arm. And anything that would have produced that much heat to disintegrate a bone and the rib cage and all that. I mean, the cops on the scene said they could look at the body and see the internal organs, which are not burned. Okay? So we're looking at evidence of a high-voltage electrocution caused by a piece of machinery that is not in the apartment. So when you realize that, you realize, hey, this had to happen somewhere else. And somebody brought the body back and faked the murder scene. And she's naked, laying on the floor, and she's been stabbed 7 or 8 times, and they piled a bunch of underwear on top of her and set it on fire, right? And they know that she's stabbed 7 or 8 times, but there are V-cuts in the underwear, so the knife went through the folded underwear when her corpse was laying there, okay? But when they did the autopsy, they discovered that the cause of death was a puncture wound to the heart. So if you bleed when you're alive and you don't bleed when you're dead, all right? So a puncture wound to a heart that hemorrhages and puts 1,200 cc's of blood in the pericardium sac was done when she was alive, but all of the other wounds did not hemorrhage and were done post-mortem after she was in an apartment. So you start to put together this puzzle here. Now, one of the things I find interesting, and as 9/11 people, I'm sure you all are hugely up to speed on the mainstream American media's bias and loyalties and stuff like that. I find it interesting that today it's been 30 years since Unsolved Mysteries began, and there's been CSI shows after CSI shows, and I mean, there's probably been 1,000 murders that have been looked at. And you look in the credits, and thanks to the FBI for telling us about these murders, okay? Nobody has ever done the Mary Sherman murder, okay? And when we get into it, I think you're going to see why they don't do it, all right? So now that we're getting into this, and we say, okay, well, what is this stuff about the secret laboratory? Well, Jim Garrison was looking into the JFK assassination, and one of the people that came up on his radar very early on was David Ferry. Well, David Ferry is a defrocked priest who got kicked out of a Jesuit seminary. He wound up being a big engine, like 4-engine airline pilot for United down in Miami. And he gets fired from that because he's got a problem with getting his hands on teenage boys. And so he loses his job, and he drifts, as many of those guys do, into the darker world where he's got one foot in the mafia, working with Carlos Marcello in New Orleans, and another foot working with the CIA on all of this stuff in Cuba. He's flying in and out of Cuba. This guy can land in the jungles at night. I mean, he's a talented pilot. He also, he's a brilliant guy, speaks 5 languages and all this stuff, but he thinks that he's got the cure for cancer, and he's doing all these cancer experiments by himself, right? Now, Jim Garrison gets interviewed in Playboy magazine, and they ask him some questions about Jack Ruby getting cancer. He said, I can't answer that, but I can tell you that we have discovered that David Ferry was conducting some kind of secret research with Dr. Mary Sherman, who got murdered, and they were working on cancer, okay? And he says, and it's not only Mary Sherman, and it's some other doctors, okay? So here we have the next part of the problem here. Mary Sherman is world class, all right? I mean, she's got all the credentials in the world. She's plugged in with the president of the American Cancer Society, the father of the atomic bomb. She's got all the stuff at the University of Chicago. And David Ferry is this defrocked priest who's running around with the anti-Castro crowd in New Orleans, and he keeps getting busted on ethics charges, okay? So you've got a loose cannon who's got a political agenda tied in with a woman who has no apparent political agenda but has all the credentials in the world for cancer and radiation, okay? Now, what burned off Mary Sherman's arm? this whole thing is an onion. You keep digging on it and stuff. But we eventually find the machine that burned off Mary Sherman's arm, and I'll come back to that in a little bit. But I want to say, who is Mary Sherman as you get into this? And who does she work for and all this other stuff? She, as I've mentioned, she's an expert in radiation and in cancer, and she runs a clinic for Dr. Alton Ochsner. Well, Ochsner has one foot in the American Cancer Society and one foot in the, let's call it the anti-communist political operations down there, because his clinic was essentially funded by the CIA and was set up to take care of the rich people from Central and South America. Okay, they could jump on a plane and fly to New Orleans and get medical care, and they didn't have to develop their own stuff. And so when Castro takes over Cuba, Ochsner has this huge problem because their revolution is threatening his entire business model for his community, hospital. And so these are problems that he has. And so you start digging again. Who's this guy Ochsner? What can you tell me about it? Oh, the other thing, besides cancer, Ochsner's got his foot in this polio vaccine. Okay, so I start digging into the polio vaccine. Remember the name Salk and the name Sabin and stuff. Does anybody here know that they grew the polio vaccine that was given to 200 million Americans on the kidneys of monkeys?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And when
only because I read your book.
Okay. Well, I mean, but that's the point. It's not. I mean, you didn't hear it on the news, you know. And I was, you know, I was one of those kids in the 50s that got this stuff. And, in fact, I remember the day I went with my older brother and sister to get the Salk shot. And I was told when I was there that they weren't going to give it to me because I was too young. And that was my father stepping in and saying my immune system wasn't developed enough for it. And at any rate, my older brother and older sister both got cancer. I did not. I've never had it. And the point is, I mean, let's go back to 9/11 for, we have, on 9/11, right, we lost 3,500 Americans due to terrorism, from the war on terrorism. due to terrorism.
Due to terrorism, yes.
Yeah. And that same day, we lost 3,000 people due to cancer. The next day, we lost 3,000 people due to cancer. The next day, we lost 3,000 people due to cancer. We have lost 12.5 million people, Americans, due to cancer since September 11th, 2001. Okay? And so the scale of what I'm talking about is, and just if you compare it to 9/11, I'm not diminishing 9/11, because it's a huge subject, and it's an important subject. But I'm saying this thing is important, too, and has some real numbers to back it up. And what happened was, in the 1950s, they launched this polio vaccine in April of 1955, and they, you know, they had the March of Dimes, which was a big PR operation out of New York, and they were all, and you know, Salk himself was out of Pittsburgh. He was being backed by the steel money over there, and they had this other guy, Albert Sabin, had a competitive strategy in it, right? So they set up the Francis trials, and a trial, that is when they inject your children without telling you to see if the vaccine works before they announce they're going to do it, okay? And in April of 1955, they announced in Ann Arbor, Michigan, they have this big press conference there. And they say the Salk vaccine is safe, effective, and proven. Everybody roll up your sleeve and get ready for it. By the way, Ms. Bernice Eddy, Dr. Bernice Eddy, MD, PhD, head of vaccine safety testing for the United States government, NIH, please approve this vaccine, like, tomorrow, because we're ready to release it. So Bernice Eddy takes this vaccine back to her lab, and she injects it into her monkeys. and she gets back dead and crippled monkeys. And she turns around and says, guys, look, there's a problem with this vaccine. I don't know what the problem is at the moment, but if you release it, you're going to wind up killing children. The good news is the problem is only with one batch from Qatar Laboratories, okay, which was set up specifically to produce Salk's vaccine. And the major stockholder of Qatar Laboratories was Alton Ochsner, Harry Sherman's boss. So they call up, NIH calls up Ochsner and says, guy, we need you to withdraw your batch from the launch. And he said, I'm not doing that. He said, I've known Jonas Salk for 20 years. And Ochsner at the time is chief of surgery at Tulane Medical School. He calls the faculty of Tulane Medical School into the amphitheater, my father and Mary Sherman in the audience. And he says, look, there's a controversy over the polio vaccine. And I'm here to tell you that it's safe. And I would not ask you to do anything that I was not willing to do myself. So right here, right now, here's my grandson and here's my granddaughter, and I'm going to inject them with Salk's vaccine, which he does. And in 48, 72 hours, his grandson is dead and his granddaughter has polio. So there was a problem with the Salk vaccine. In fact, the Salk vaccine gets withdrawn from the market 3 weeks after it's launched. Eisenhower gives Salk a nice plaque on the White House lawn, but the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, who's Ovetta Hobby, gets fired. And the entire management of the National Institutes of Health gets fired. And they have to come up with another vaccine. So they come up with the Sabin vaccine. Now, there's a difference between the two, but the Sabin vaccine uses what I'll call polio light, but it's grown on monkey kidney cells from the rhesus monkey. Okay? And what happens is after they release 100 million doses of the Sabin vaccine, two researchers up at NCI, NIH, by the name of Bernice Eddy, she's the vaccine safety tester, and Sarah Stewart, who's a classmate and personal friend of Mary Sherman, they discover a cancer-causing virus in their laboratory. They name it polyoma. Poly means many, oma means tumor. This one virus is creating... Hey, Dwayne. Okay. The point here is that they discover a cancer-causing virus, which before long, they're getting all this money from Congress now, this new hope, right? And they're passing out these electron microscopes, and they start cataloging all the viruses in the monkeys, and they discover the natural host of polyoma, which is the rhesus monkey, and they give it a new name. They call it SV40. S means simian. That's scientific jargon for monkey. So it's monkey virus number 40, but it's called SV40. You can Google it under that. And they realize that it's in the polio vaccine, which they have just released 100 million doses of. Right? There's a cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine. And the question is, I mean, I'm doing my reading. I'm saying, wait a second. If there's a cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine, do we have an epidemic today related to it? Okay. So the next thing I do is I go and get I go to the medical library and I get the statistics from the National Cancer Institute, and I go back home to my computer and I make all the graphs, and they're in the book around page 210. And there is this enormous eruption of soft tissue cancers that happens during this 16-year window after the polio vaccine that we have access to. And so I start doing the math on this, and, you know, I mean, the first question, when I started this, I was 20 years ago when I came out with my first version of this book, nobody was talking about the word cancer epidemic, right? And let me ask you, do you know anybody in your friend or family circle with cancer? I get a lot of yeses on that. In fact, I get like 9 out of 10 people say, yeah, of course. So the question is, do we have a cancer epidemic today? Yes, I think we do. And is the mainstream media and so the question is, do we do we have a cancer epidemic today, and is it the result of the cancer-causing virus that was in the polio vaccine? Okay? And that's the first major part of this story, all right? Then we start getting into who are these people, all right? And one of the things I did in my first version of this book, I theorized that in order to do this, in order for, and I personally heard that Ferry had this cancer lab in his apartment when I was in New Orleans. The question there becomes, who's doing the actual work? I mean, you got to know what you're doing to handle cancer-causing monkey viruses in a laboratory, okay? And that's when I get a phone call from 60 Minutes, and they say, we got this really interesting woman here we're looking into, and she keeps telling us that she was like the laboratory technician in your book. And that first book was called Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. And do you want to talk to us? You know, I said, well, yeah, sure. You know, I want to keep an eye on this thing, if nothing else. Well, it turns out that this gal is from Florida. I happen to live in the same town that she was raised in. And the she watches her grandmother die at when she's middle school, 13 or so. And she decides she wants to be the person to find the cure for cancer. And so she gets going on finding the cure for cancer while she's in high school. And she's got all this support from the community, from the American Cancer Society, from her professor, I mean her teacher, physics teacher in high school. And she's wins all these science competitions, and she's getting money from the American Medical Society and the American Cancer Society, and she's even getting exotic chemicals and advice from the U.S. Army, from their AMARID program. She's got all the documents to prove this, okay? And so what happens in March of 1961, she's a senior in high school, the American Cancer Society is having their annual press briefing right up the road from where she lives in St. Petersburg, Florida. And she, lots of moxie, she gets her high school press pass out, and she goes and crashes the American Cancer Society press briefing. And they're getting ready to kick her out, and somebody said, wait a second, we've never had anything like this happen before. Let's find out who this gal is. And she said, I got all this information I need to tell you. You know, and they let her stay for lunch. And at lunch, she explains to the senior vice president for research of the American Cancer Society that she is giving cancer to mice in 7 days. And this guy says, young lady, you realize what you're saying here and to whom you're saying it, because nobody is doing this in 7 days. And she says, well, if you'd like to come to my laboratory, I'll show you. I mean, here are my notes, but my laboratory is right down the road. This guy, Deal, the guy from the American Cancer Society, picks up the telephone and calls his buddy, Dr. Alton Oshner, and said, Alton, get down here. There's somebody I need you to meet, okay? So Oshner flies down with this other old guy in a baggy gray suit, and the three of them, Oshner, Deal and the other guy, get in the car with Judith and go back to her high school to look at her lab. Okay? So I said, Judy, who's this other guy? She said, oh, his name's Urey. He's from the University of Chicago. Now, this is Harold Urey, who ran the War Sciences program at Columbia University during World War II. Okay? And the question is not associating him with with Judith is, why is he flying around with Dr. Alton Ochsner in the spring of 1961, okay? Well, this has to do with how Mary Sherman's arm gets blown off, and we'll go back to that in a minute. And so once these people realize that there is they've already released 100 million doses of a contaminated polio vaccine, and they have another 100 million on the shelf. And they're not going to call a press conference and say, oops, guess what we just did? We just mass inoculated the entire nation's children population with a cancer-causing virus. They're not going to do that. They stamp it secret, and they get really busy trying to develop a vaccine, an anti-cancer vaccine. Well, when I started this 20 years ago, I mean, people said, well, there are no anti-cancer vaccines, and cancer is not caused by a virus. And so today, we have the human papillomavirus, Gardasil, which is a vaccine to stop a cancer-causing virus. All right? So they can't deny it anymore. I mean, they're out there marketing this stuff. Okay? So this whole thing has changed a bit over the years. And so, but they're in a hurry, and they need to get, you know, the virus to mutate, to change, to come up with a more benign strain that they can use in a vaccine. And so they set up this operation. They set it up in New Orleans, right down the street from Dr. Alton Ochsner's house. They set it up on the grounds of the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, which is sometimes referred to as the Marine Hospital, because the Marines provide the security for the hospital. So there's Marines with guns at the gates, okay? And there's about 13 buildings on this, and on one of the buildings on the back, we find all the evidence of a very powerful electronic machine, about 5 million volts in there, and that was the linear particle accelerator that they were using to mutate this SV40 virus in order to try to create a vaccine. Now, they're doing this in 1961. I got a list of the people that I believe are involved in it. One of them was Jose Rivera, who's a bioweapons expert, who, you know, we find him at Fort Detrick in, 1959, and then he winds up being the head of neurology and blindness at the National Institutes of Health in 63 or so. And between those two assignments, Fort Detrick and there, he's in New Orleans teaching introductory biology at Loyola University, which is a college that doesn't even have a medical school, okay? But it happens to be right down the street from the linear particle accelerator, all right? So we got this collection of people right there, and then we get this weird thing that happens right at this time, which affects the game dramatically. And that is the Russians move mid-range nuclear missiles into Cuba, all right? Now, New Orleans, the main business in New Orleans is trade, you know. I mean, like cars in Detroit and stuff, trade in New Orleans. And the Cuban revolution took 25% of the trade out of it. And New Orleans is really concerned about this stuff of Cuba exporting the revolution to the rest of Latin America. And now you've got Russian missiles in the middle of it. So what they decide to do at that point is they got to get rid of this guy Castro. And the CIA is running around looking for people to help them do it. And they decide to weaponize this SV40 virus project that they're doing so that they can create something, an aggressive cancer, that can be used to kill Fidel Castro. At least that's the rationale that's being presented to the people involved. And in order to do this, they open up a sort of a back door to this project, and these are cellularized laboratories and stuff around town, and one of them is the house across the street from where David Ferry lives, and that's where they are growing all the mice. They've got several thousand mice in there. That's in the Garrison interview I mentioned earlier. And they got two Cuban guys that live there, and they bring mice over in cardboard boxes to David Ferry's apartment, where his kitchen is suddenly turned into a laboratory. They kill the mice. They cut out the tumors. They put them in a blender. They grind them up. They put them back in test tubes, label everything, make the slides, and send it back to Dr. Sherman. Now, in order to do this, in order to have this person that knows how to handle the cancer-causing viruses, that's where Judy Ferry Baker comes in. Because after she shows the American Cancer Society that she is giving cancer to mice faster than they're doing it at NCI, and she's a high school kid in a dirt floor lab, they bring her up to Buffalo, New York, to the Roswell Park Cancer Institute, and they have her trained to handle cancer-causing viruses. Then they put her in the University of Florida, and they've got her doing research that they don't want to do in public. Okay? Secret research. Like what? Well, will this cancer-causing virus, will radiation from x-rays trigger this cancer-causing virus in everybody's bloodstream system now to start the cancer? Okay? I mean, think that question through for a minute. That threatens the entire use of x-ray in American medicine. You know? I mean, it's a big, heavy question, and you don't want to ask it in public. And so in October of 62, we get the Cuban Missile Crisis. In the spring of 63, not long after that, Ochsner calls up Judith Ferry at the time, who's a student at University of Florida, and says, Judy, how'd you like to skip the last 2 years of college? We can put you into Tulane Medical School in the fall, and we'll pay your tuition and your room and board and give you a stipend, and there's just one thing we need you to do. We need you to come to New Orleans this summer and do some work for us, and you'll be working under the wing of that famous cancer researcher, Dr. Mary Sherman. Well, would you like to do this, Judy? Of course Judy does. I mean, you know, her dream is finding the cure for cancer, and she's just been offered the dream job of her career and getting in the back door of medical school and having all of her bills paid and everything else. I mean, so she says yes, and she comes to New Orleans, and she is intercepted in her first couple of days in New Orleans at the post office by this guy. They need somebody to take care of her. She's running around shooting off her mouth. She's 19 years old. So they send in this Marine with intelligence training, who is Lee Harvey Oswald. And within 24 hours of Oswald meeting her, he introduces her to David Ferry. Within another 24 hours, Mary Sherman shows up at David Ferry's apartment. A week later, when it's time for Judy to meet face-to-face with Ochsner to kick off this project, it's Lee Oswald that sets up the meeting. All right, so we got Lee Oswald in the middle of this. He's working with the CIA. He's, you know, got, and he's from New Orleans, right? He's from New Orleans. He's from a mafia family in New Orleans. He's on first-name basis with people like Carlos Marcello. And so this whole thing is tied in with this. And if I can put this last point into about 2 minutes, just because that's about what I have left here. When you start shooting radiation through a virus...
Please take as much time as you need, okay? I don't think anybody wants to have you feel forced for time, so please just finish your presentation whatever time you need, okay?
Okay, thank you. Generous of you. The point is, when Oswald gets to New Orleans, he finds Judy a place to live. He sets her up in her cover job. Oswald and Judith, or Judy as I tend to call her, start their jobs at the Riley Coffee Company on the same day. They're referred by the same employment agency. They both are cleared by an ex-FBI agent who's the vice president of the company. And in case you don't know, the Riley Coffee Company imports coffee from Central America. You think they're in on this anti-communist thing? Okay? Or at least family members are. And so what you've got is you've got a paper trail proving that Judy worked at the Riley Coffee Company started on the same day that Oswald started working at the Riley Coffee Company. And Oswald gets her an apartment right off Magazine Street. He lives on Magazine Street. The Riley Coffee Company's on Magazine Street. There's a bus that goes down the Magazine Street and picks up Lee Oswald, picks up Judy, and drops him off at the Riley Coffee Company. And this is all, I've got a map about this in my book. This is all in uptown New Orleans. There's Ochsner's house, there's Mary's house, there's David Ferry's apartment. You know, it's all right there. And so this goes on through the summer. And what they're doing is they're taking So there's a house across the street from David Ferry where the mice live, okay? Well, they're injecting these mice with cancer, or with a virus that causes cancer. And they're waiting for the tumors to grow. Once the tumors get really big, like the size of the mice and stuff, they put a bunch of them in a cardboard box, the Cuban guys, bring them across the street to David Ferry's apartment, and Judy and Lee stand there and kill the mice and make the slides and all that stuff I mentioned before. And they're doing this while they are clocked in at the Riley Coffee Company. Okay? Even Judy's husband doesn't know she's doing this. Okay? And this whole thing is going on there, and they're killing mice, and Ochsner is in charge of this project. And it's Judy that brings the test tubes over to Mary Sherman's apartment. Okay? So what we find here is there is this loop. Well, once Mary Sherman gets them, she says, oh, these are the strongest ones. Let's give them some more radiation. And she brings them back to the public health hospital where the linear particle accelerator is and gives them another dose of radiation. Then they go back to the mouse house, as we call it, where they raise. And so there is this loop. And the virus is getting stronger and stronger and stronger, which is what they wanted to do. And they've killed thousands of mice at this point. Then they start testing it on monkeys, first marmosets from Latin America. And they kill all those guys. And then they're working their way up the evolutionary ladder here. And they're going to test it on African green monkeys. Okay, and Tulane's got this big laboratory, Delta Regional Primate Center, and they get a bunch of African green monkeys and they test it on that, and that's great. It kills the African greens too. Now they got to test it on the ultimate primate. We got to find out if this thing kills a human being. And so, where do you get a human being you can kill and nobody's going to notice? Well, how about death row from Angola Penitentiary, which is in southeast Louisiana? And so what they do is they set this thing up where they're going to get this, quote, volunteer, and he's going to be transferred over to this mental hospital. Now, this is a hospital for the criminally insane. Like, it's got security around it, right? A big fence and guards at the gate and everything. You can't just walk in and see Aunt Edna. You got to get through security and all this stuff, right? So they develop this plan that they're going to take the biological weapon from New Orleans, drive it up to where this mental hospital is, which is in Jackson, Louisiana, and the prisoner is going to get brought over to the mental hospital, and right before it gets to the hospital, they're going to get in line behind the van where the prisoner is, and they're going to go in like a convoy. They're going to all get waved in together, the weapon and everything else. So they get up there, and they have to wait for a while. They don't want to wait in this little town, so they go down the road about 12 miles, and they wait in Clinton, Louisiana, right? And Clinton, Louisiana is what you call the county seat in most places in Louisiana, it's a fair seat. But it's got a big courthouse in it, right? And so these guys are planning on going and waiting by the payphone underneath the shade of the oak tree in front of the courthouse for the phone call that says the prisoner has left Angola. And that's their cue to go out and get in line behind them. And so they're expecting an empty courthouse, an empty area in front of the courthouse, because it is late August in Louisiana. It is hot, okay? Nobody hangs out in the sunshine there. You know, it's going to be deserted, right? And so what they didn't do was they didn't read the newspaper. I mean, they picked the date August 29th at random. They didn't realize that on August 28th, Martin Luther King was doing his I Have a Dream speech in Washington. And because of that, the Congress on Racial Equality, which is a nationwide organization run out of the University of Chicago, has planned black voter registration drives for the next day to travel on the momentum of it. Okay? So what's going on in Clinton, Louisiana that day is you got a line of blacks waiting to register to vote, and they're getting a hard time. Everyone's giving them reading tests and stuff like that. And on the other side, you got all these white, angry white Klanners, Ku Klux Klanners with their arms crossed, being very unhappy about what they're seeing. And in the middle, you got this poor guy by the name of John Manchester, who's the town marshal. And the only thing he doesn't want is trouble. Okay, so he's sitting there, he's standing there in the shade, watching this scene. Into the scene drives a black Cadillac. Hey, Joe, you know who these guys are. So Manchester goes over to the Cadillac, pulls his badge, and says, may I see your driver's license and ID, please? And the guy says, sure. Takes out his driver's license, says, I am Clay Shaw from the International Trademark. Now, if you remember the JFK movie, this is the guy that Garrison arrests, okay, for his involvement with Oswald. And this young white guy gets out of the back of the car and goes over and gets in line with the blacks. He's fairly noticeable because he's the only white guy in line. And he tries to register to vote. He wants to see if they'll let him register because he's white, even though he doesn't live in the area. And he actually signs the ledger there. His name is Lee Harvey Oswald. And the third person in the car is this guy with this orange wig on and big eyebrows. It's Davis Ferry, in case you don't recognize him. And we know all this because during the HSCA investigation in the 70s, they tracked down this John Manchester guy, who was the town marshal. They brought him up to Washington, D.C., and they had him testify to the assassination committee. But they did it in secret because they didn't want to tell the people that Garrison's main claim, which was the fact that he had associated Shaw and Oswald, was true. Okay? But what they're doing up there is they're bringing the biological weapon up to test on a human. Well, finally, the phone rings. They get their phone call. They go on over to the mental hospital. They inject the guy with the cancer weapon to see if it works, but they got to wait 48 hours for a blood test. So they all come back to New Orleans. So this is 4 hours up and 4 hours back, and they got a couple hours up there. This is a whole day activity. And this idea that they're using this mental hospital to make Oswald look crazy is wrong, because the big mental hospital in Louisiana at the time is right across the lake from New Orleans, right? They don't have to drive 4 hours to get there. And so 2 days later, they need to do a blood test. And they need to do a special blood test, which will identify if the cancer has kicked in. And there's only a handful of people in the country who's been trained to do this, and one of them is Judy, because she was trained to do it up at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York. So Lee Oswald drives Judy Baker, Judith Ferry Baker, from New Orleans up to the mental hospital in Jackson, Louisiana. And he knows he's being set up at this point. He starts leaving a breadcrumb trail, which is too much for me to get into now. But there are witnesses who see him and remember him from being up there. And actually, the closing arguments of the Garrison trial are interesting because his assistant district attorney who's handling it says, you know, we've got witnesses who saw Lee Oswald in Jackson, Louisiana, at the end of the summer, and he was driving around in an old beat-up green car, not the black Cadillac, old beat-up green car, and there was a woman on the front seat driving with him. And we just assumed that was Marina until we talked to Marina, and Marina says, no, that wasn't me. I never went up there. Okay? So there's a woman out there we know that was going with Lee Oswald. We don't know who she is. We don't know why she was there. We can't find her right now, but we wish we knew who she was because we want to bring her into the courtroom and ask her questions. Well, that person is Judith Ferry Baker. Okay? And we now have her autobiography about all this. And the final question here is, of these emerging global epidemics that I mentioned, one being the cancer epidemic that we have now, the question on AIDS comes up, you know? And the timeline that I found in Scientific American said case one was 1960. Okay? Well, they've tried to screw up that timeline in the media since then, but that was what the epidemiologist said, okay? And that's right when they had this linear particle accelerator in New Orleans mutating these monkey viruses. And so I don't come to a grand conclusion on that, but I say if I'm putting together a list of possible causes of AIDS, I would put this on the list as one of the possible causes. And that pretty much covers my waterfront here, I think.
Well, Mr. Heflin, I would say that anybody who has listened to your presentation and has not read your book and doesn't want to get a hold of it has probably been asleep for the last 45 minutes. But let's see, we've got some time for a few questions here. I would ask everybody who would like to ask a question or make a comment to keep it very brief because we do have other items on the agenda and we're running fairly far behind. So please be considerate. Who would like to make a comment or ask Dr. or Mr. Hedlund a question? Go ahead.
Barbara.
Barbara. Who else?
Richard Sachs.
Richard. Who else?
Dan Hennicoll.
I'm sorry?
Dan Hennon.
Dan Hennon. Who else?
David Cole.
David. Who else? Okay, I'll put myself last on the list. Go ahead, Barbara.
Yeah, thank you so much. Couple of questions. The first, this is Barbara. I'll start again.
Okay.
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, okay, good. First off, thank you so much for your book, for your dedication. Kind of a housekeeping question. I believe you've already done an interview with Bonnie Faulkner. Is that correct?
Yes, and I have a website which has about 15 hours of interviews and other videos on it, which I just want to call your attention to. That's drmarysmonkey.com, but spell out Dr. D-O-C-T-O-R. But if you just Google my name and Dr. Mary's Monkey, you'll get, particularly on YouTube, you get all that stuff, and Bonnie Faulkner's interview is on.
Is one of them. Okay.
Yes, right.
So to my question, very simple. The first one is, the implication here is that they put Mary's body in this accelerator, if I correctly. And number two, is there an anthrax connection to the biowarfare development investigated?
On the second point, no, there's not an anthrax connection. I know a fair amount about that, but it's not a connection to this story. The point of what happened to Mary Sherman, it is my position that someone booby-trapped the machine that she was working on because they knew about her connection with Lee Oswald. Oh, that's a whole other thing I didn't get into. Lee Oswald is coming over to Mary Sherman's apartment, taking these things that when she's finished with them and flushing them down the toilet in the neighbor's apartment. We got witnesses to that, okay? And I think somebody booby-traps it, and what happens with Mary, she grabs the handle to turn the machine off and on, you know, like a circuit breaker thing,
right.
And she's standing in front of a steel wall. And normally when you get a high voltage electrocution, the feet come off, okay, because it's going to the ground. But her feet are fine here. What happens is she's standing in front of this wall, which we find in the building, and the wall itself is grounded with a heavy cable. So the electricity goes into her hand, up her arm, and out the back to this wall, which is why her rib cage is gone down to her hips there. And it's clearly, quote, an industrial accident. The question is, was the accident accidental or not? I personally think it was sabotage. If they wanted to kill her, they could have killed her much easier. They could have just shot her or stabbed her or, you know, kidnapped her or something. The point of this seems to me that they were trying to draw attention to the location, and this all happens the day the Warren Commission begins its investigation into Oswald in New Orleans, and they've got documents connecting Oswald to the U.S. Public Health Service sitting there on their desk when this happens.
Okay, so there's no question in your mind that that's what killed her, that electrocution, rather than a puncture to the heart.
Well, if a high-voltage electrocution does not cross your heart, you can get dismembered, which is what happened to her, but the heart is still beating. Okay, so what I think happened was that the people who were with her, who were doctors, okay, realized they had a massive problem on the hands, and she was not going to recover, and she would not want to recover. She'd be blind, and her, you know, half her torso is gone, or a quarter of it. And so somebody terminates her by stabbing her, puncturing with a very slim surgical instrument into the heart. It's a mercy killing at that point. And now they got to get her body back to her apartment where they fake this other murder scene. So it's a movie script. You know, it's an involved operation. But what they don't want to do is they don't want to bring the ambulances and the fire trucks and everything else to this laboratory, because this laboratory is a medical Manhattan project. It is one of the secretest things in the United States government, and they don't want it exposed.
All right, got it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Richard, are you having another call?
No. Yeah, thank you. Ed, that was a great presentation. And
thank you.
I really appreciate it, too. You did a great job. And I really hate to make a comment right now, because I'm hearing a lot of information that's not very safe to have coming from about 50 years of my own research, and part of it is related to vaccines and cancer and a lot of other things related to that. But I have to, it's not ethical for me to say nothing. So I have a page of real quick notes in response to what you said. I'm going to go through them really fast because I don't want to take up people's time. Some of them are going to make me sound completely crazy, and it's absolutely fine if people want to think that. What's more dangerous to me is if people realize that this is not crazy. So this is in no particular order, a bunch of quick observations.
Good.
First of all, as far as I've been able to tell, and I've looked into it extremely deeply, all the vaccines as far as health benefits are 100% scam intentionally. And the people that don't know that are at the lower and middle levels, regardless of credentials. And the credentials are important, but they're not relevant in the way that we think they are, because there's massive programming, overt and not obvious, that goes into the basically cult programming during those training years that the people are involved in. So there are no benefits. They're guaranteed harm. They're a perfect weapon. The cancer epidemic, I think, came largely from what you explained. It also has other parallel causes, also intentional. Almost none of it is unintentional, and those involved a lot of other things that most of us have heard of, but they're not by accident. As far as the cure for cancer, I'm going as fast as I can here. The cure for cancer has been known for a very, very long time. This information is violently suppressed. The organizations, agencies, government departments that are supposedly working on the cancer cure are 100% fraud, and the only ones that don't know that are working in them are not at the top level. As far as an anti-cancer vaccine is concerned, HPV is not an anti-cancer vaccine. It just pretends to be. It doesn't prevent cancer, but it kills and maims children. And it also has weaponized possibilities. And nobody who actually knows what's going on with all this believes that any real vaccine to prevent disease will ever be found, because that's not the point. And these organizations are not out there to do that, except for weaponized purposes, and they are safe and effective for that. As far as grinding up the tumors to study what comes out of those, in terms of the cancer-causing virus that must be in there, that's been going on ever since, except that now the current version has refined what comes out of those tumors, harvested from cancer patients where they get operations, and they refined it down to a few refined ingredients, one of which is the enzyme called NAGLase. And the recent spate of deaths of the doctors working on a group of 1,100 autistic kids and some other associated projects that cured 60% of them, what they did is they found out that the NAGLase was being put into the vaccines, injected on purpose to kill immune systems all over the general public, but that's one of the big factors.
Well, Richard,
autism.
You can see how come I fell down the rabbit hole on this. Because
yeah,
this thing is an octopus, and it goes out in all the directions you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. I'm almost done here.
Okay.
I mean, just a couple of other little things, and I'll shut up. Anyway, that couldn't be allowed to be exposed with the NAGLase, which originated from looking for the weaponized virus potential in those ground-up tumors you mentioned. And so those doctors were killed recently, and that's still going on. There's about 30 of them now that are dead. And
30? Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And the vaccines are one of probably at least 20 major weaponized programs that are directed entirely against the people by the upper levels of the power structure. So
let me make a technical point about AIDS here.
Sure.
In the polio vaccine, where the SV40 was, there was also SIV, which is a simian immunodeficiency virus, which is the ancestor of HIV. Now, it has been, it's what I call a near miss. People tried to float the idea that HIV was in the polio vaccine. It was not, all right? But they started shooting radiation through these test tubes that had the polio vaccine in it in order to hit the SV40. And when they did it, they also hit the SIV. And that is technically, I think, a very reasonable explanation for how SIV gets mangled and becomes HIV-1.
Yeah, we have a serious problem, and the problem is really not the technical details. As I say, the cure for cancer has been found long ago. The problem is malevolent people in the power structure that the general public is still not aware of.
Yeah, and the FDA is supposed to represent us to the industry, and it represents the industry to us. It's, I mean, that's the other problem here.
Richard, if the count is up to 30 as opposed to the 14 that we were talking about in your last thing, then it sounds like you probably need an update from you in the near future, huh?
We might want to do that. Yeah, it's still developing, actually.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, Dan Hennen?
Hi, Ed. This is Dan Hennen. I like your presentation. It was awesome. I've been following your interviews for the last 5 years, mainly with Dave Emery, going back many years, so I really enjoy your work. I have created a Facebook page last year called Inquiry into the Murder of Dr. Mary Sherman. We currently have 115 members. It's just a kind of a location for where people can post their information on that, on her strange death. So just if anyone's out there and interested, we do have a page out on Facebook. That's just a public group that's going through it. I'm very interested in that case myself. But once again, thanks for coming on.
Good. Dan, send me an email at author@drmarysfunky.com about the Facebook thing. Thank you.
All right, we'll do.
Dan,
may I ask you that email address, DR or DOCTOR?
It's DOCTOR, Mary's, no apostrophe, monkey.com, author@.
Yes, thank you.
Dan, if you want to CC Craig on that, then maybe we can get that in the minutes as well so others can be aware of it. Okay.
All right, we'll do.
Okay, take it. David?
Hello, Ed. I've been in touch with Ed in the past, and it's good to hear him speaking again. I think the reason I contacted him before was hearing him on Bonnie Faulkner's interview last year, I believe, or the year before. This appears to me to be a purposeful bioweapon, amongst others, and you take into account the deliberate attempts to make it stronger with radiation, and then all you got to do is look at the nuclear industry and ask yourself why they push forward with this just insane electrical generation system, and they put those things in the most precarious places, along fault lines and near population centers. I mean, it's just
and on beaches
we're living
in Japan. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, we're living in it's like a twilight zone. But I have no doubt that that this is purposeful bioengineering and geoengineering.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Dave.
Tim, I have a question for you. This has to do with the statement that only the office provenance had the simian virus issue in the initial phase. Is that the totality of the issue regarding the cancer propagation, or was the follow-up vaccine also responsible for the same carcinogenic properties?
When they discovered
the vaccine.
When they discovered the contamination of the polio vaccine, they had given out 100 million doses, and there were another 100 million doses on the shelf. They did not want to tell the public what they had done, so they continued to distribute the other 100 million doses at the time. So that was the entire run of the Sabin vaccine. There was an article in the New York Times about page 26 or something, saying that they were going to withdraw the polio vaccine until they could remove a monkey virus from it. They didn't use the word cancer in the article. But it shows that they knew about it, but they were doing a limited hangout, and they were not admitting to all this stuff. But the guys at the top all knew. And you know, Mary knew. Mary explained it to Judy, you know. So, does that answer the question?
Yes, it does. For the time being, I'll probably ask you my email for further details. But thank you. And thank you so much for spending your time with us and this very excellent presentation that hopefully will inspire others to want to get a hold of your book and the further details and the documentation that you provide there. Thanks for spending your time with us.
Good. Thank you very much.
Could I just ask Barb to close the circle? Could you comment briefly on the link, if any, direct link to the JFK assassination?
Yeah, Lee Oswald was going over to Mary Sherman's apartment on a regular basis. He was at Judith Berry Baker's elbow the entire time. Judy was working out of Mary's apartment. If they had not arrested Lee Oswald for JFK's assassination, there might not be much of a link, but they did, okay? And because you've got this Lee there going in and out of Juan Valdez's apartment, flushing the toilet 30 times in a row, and his involvement with all this, I mean, Lee was a government agent, and he was penetrating the plot to kill Kennedy. He told Judy on July 29th, that they were going to kill Kennedy, and he was afraid they were setting him up to blame it on him. Okay? And so there is, you know, one is the fact that they just blamed it on Lee. I mean, but Lee knew so much. He knew about the biological weapon. He had met with the plotters. You know, he could identify people. I mean, if he got into a courtroom, it was bad news for them. That's why they had to get him killed. ASAP, they were supposed to kill him on the 22nd. They missed, you know? So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you again, Shannon.
Okay, thank you much.
Okay, I was remiss in not following the draft agenda. I was remiss in not following the draft agenda, which required taking up some of the housekeeping issues first. So I'm going to go ahead and take those up now and try to get through them as quickly as I can. There's three of them. The first one has to do with keeping the April teleconference reserved solely for the debate between Barbara and Adam and Craig. Due to the responses that we got on the survey, a solid majority of people felt there was not enough time devoted to the debate. So because that debate is scheduled for the April conference, I want to make sure that we go ahead and reserve the entire April South conference for that purpose so that we have plenty of time for it. If there's no objections, we'll do that. Any objections?
I just have a question, Barb. Is one of the participants, does that mean that we will revisit how long we have for each segment, I suppose.
Of course. Yeah, we'll have to redistribute the time to, you know, we'll take up the rest of the conference. Take up the entire conference.
You'll be getting feedback from Adam and I about that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay.
But,
so can I ask for a clarification? This is Craig. If we're agreeing to this tonight, does that mean that we've all that we have agreed to increase the length of time for the presentations automatically, or is this something that is still to be discussed?
No. It's assumed that we will therefore have additional time for each of the segments of the debate. Okay.
I'm not prepared to make that decision tonight. I didn't really realize that we were going to be locking ourselves into that.
Well, there's no requirement to take up the full amount of time. I mean, if you have X amount of time for your presentation, you can yield as much time as you wish.
I have no interest. Yeah, but I mean, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take the full amount of time. But I didn't realize that we were talking about making a decision on changing the time limits for each section of the debate in this particular thing. I would prefer sort of not deciding that tonight because, for one thing, Adam's not on the call.
Craig, I am on the call. I came on the call late. This is Adam Ruff.
Okay. Hi, Adam. Okay.
Well, look, Craig, I mean, the majority of the people that responded to the thing felt that in the last debate, in which Adam felt pretty rushed, I think, and having to present your constructive and some of your other, segments, that they didn't want to have to, you know, see that again because they felt that there should be more time devoted to the debate. So the point is that if we allow this full hour and a half, for as much of the hour and a half as we need, to give everybody the opportunity to fully present their constructive and rebuttal arguments, I mean, I think that's what people were saying, okay? So that's what we want to try to accomplish. And whether it will take the entire teleconference or not remains to be seen, but the point is that we want to expand the amount of time allowed for each of these segments to the point where they can be presented in a more relaxed and full manner, okay?
Well, we also want to make sure that there's more time if we do that for the Q's and A's. That's very important.
More time for what, Barbara?
The Q's and A's, the comments and questions.
Well, that too, although that wasn't as strong of an issue for the respondents, is the question of whether the debaters were being given adequate amount of time to present the case. So, but yeah, I mean, so, you know, maybe it won't be in the full hour and a half, but it will still be entirely devoted to the teleconference and to the debate so that sufficient time is allowed for a relaxed presentation, okay? And that will be debated between, I mean, that will be the range between you and Barbara and Adam as to exactly how we'll pull that off, okay?
Well, with you as the moderator, getting to all of this.
Right, but I'm just saying that I don't see any other way we can do this and be responsive to the results of the survey, okay? And the point of the survey was to determine whether or not we needed more time, or whether we had enough time, or whether we should use less time, or whatever, and that's the end result of that. Okay.
Yeah. I just didn't realize that it was gonna lead to a decision tonight, a firm decision tonight. But I'm not against it. But I'm just
okay.
Was not expecting it.
Okay.
So Mr. Wayne, can I make a comment?
Who?
Wayne.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, I just want to point out the amount of effort it takes to develop the presentations and the materials and the arguments is quite considerable. And to expand it is difficult. I've always viewed these debates as a place to stake out the differences, ask questions, and then to go back and do further research, of which I've done, and that's on the 9/11 telecon Yahoo group. But, you know, I think I would almost say it's unreasonable to expand the debate to an hour and a half. You ultimately end up in a place where you reach a disconnect, and you have to either go back and do a disconnect. You're at loggerheads, and you have to then go back and do some more research or something else, which is what I've had to do to answer the questions that have been raised and asked of me. So I would prefer to keep the same length just on the speaker's presenter's behalf, but they can speak for themselves. Okay. Over.
All right. Then I'll take that as an objection to reserving the teleconference for that purpose. And
I'd like to jump in, Mrs. Farr.
Before you do, I think we need to accept the fact that we are going to have to debate this issue after all. So I'll take a stack of people that would like to speak for and against expanding the reserving the teleconference for the debate.
Barbara,
on the stack, who else would like to be on the stack?
And this is just Andy Skill. I just want to tell you that I'm here. I arrived late, but
thank
I am
you,
here.
Andy. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay.
Go ahead,
great.
Yeah, I guess you're going well with that. Go ahead.
I'd like to join too.
Craig after Bart. Go ahead.
Oh, me go ahead.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm just I just want to facilitate the debate process. I'm willing to do it either way. I don't think that that Ken is proposing that the debate segments be expanded to be a total of an hour and a half. That would be unreasonable. But
sure,
some additional expanse of each segment, maybe by a minute or two, is not unreasonable. I'm willing to keep the time the way it's been for each segment. I'm willing to expand it slightly and be sure and have expanded time for comments and questions from some people who are on the call. That would be my preference, but I'm willing to do it either way.
If I could preclude you for a second here, Craig, suppose that we say that instead of 45-minute limit on the debate, it would be an hour limit and then a half an hour reserved for comments and questions and discussion. Does that seem unreasonable to you?
Well, to be honest, the thing that's making me most uncomfortable is having to make a snap decision on this without having a chance to really think it through. That's the thing that's concerning me the most. I'd like to sort of think through whether 45 minutes or an hour makes a lot of difference. I mean, I'm just having to sort of wing it. We were rushed. There's no question about that. I'm not personally, I didn't think the question part was the part that was rushed. I thought if we're going to say it's discussion, I think that's different than saying questions, because last time it was purely questions of the debaters.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to make it longer, then perhaps we should broaden it and say it's not just questions, but it's discussion in
mm-hmm.
general, so
mm-hmm.
that it doesn't necessarily
sure. Sure.
have to involve a question.
With more time, we have that option. With less time, we don't. Yeah. But that's true. That's certainly true.
but anyway, just to reiterate, I mean, you know, maybe an hour and 15 is reasonable, or maybe an hour and 10 is reasonable. I just kind of feel like I would like to maybe finalize it on the next call. I don't know if that's waiting too long or not, but...
This is Barb. The question is, whose decision? Is this something the group votes on, or that just the three of us
it's going to have to be something the group votes on, since the objection was raised, unfortunately. So, therefore, it becomes a matter of contention. Yes, it has to be voted on.
Okay, well, then I make a motion that we expand the entire debate, expanding each segment slightly so the total debate time is an hour, leaving a half an hour for discussion and Q&As. Do I hear a second?
Does somebody care to second Barbara's proposal?
Wait, hold on. Sorry, 45 minutes, where does that figure come from anyway? Because if you total up the number of minutes that we actually speak during the debate, it's not 45 minutes. So I'm not even sure where we're getting 45.
What is it, Craig?
I think he's right, Ken. I think it was like 38 or 36.
It was approximately
40. Yes, you're correct. I stand corrected. So it's 40, and it would be expanded to up to an hour, but not necessarily a full hour. You know, there's no reason why we have to take a full hour and a half for the teleconference. Just we proceed with the debate, and everybody feels they have reasonable time, and there's plenty of time for discussion, and there's nothing left to say, then we can certainly end the debate early. There's no reason why it has to last an hour and a half. Initially, it was an hour long, thing anyway. So,
yeah.
Well, there's a motion on the floor, and I'm just proposing
Ken proposed. So, Ken, do you want to second it?
Yeah, I'll second it. I'll second Bob's proposal, although I really don't like to do that as a moderator, but I'll do it in this case. The proposal is seconded that the debate time be expanded to up to an hour, and the response time, including questions, answers, and discussion, be expanded up to 30 minutes, or the remainder of an hour and a half, whichever comes last. Who would like to speak for or against the proposal?
Barbara.
And who else? Okay, Barbara, go ahead.
Yeah, before the vote, I think because the way that the proposed vote language is up to, I'm assuming that Ken would work out how much more amongst the three of us, with him as the go-between, between now and the next call. Is that correct, Ken?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So, I, in other words, if there's a very strong objection after Craig and Adam have discussed it before we work it out by email, the four of us, then, you know, it's probably going to end up the way it was, but it could be more than that up to an hour. I think that's what we're voting on. Is that correct?
Right. That's correct.
Okay.
Okay, so anybody else want to speak to the question? If not, then all in favor of Barbara's motion, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay. Okay, so the motion passes, and I'll work it out with Barbara and Adam and Craig as to what the specific details will be, and then we'll just reserve the call conference for that. Okay, thank you. Now, moving ahead to the other two items on the draft agenda. The first one is new survey has been created. It was noted in the draft agenda. I'd ask that everyone who has any interest in having a voice in how we may add additional teleconferences or a different additional time to teleconference or other options, please follow the link and just take a brief survey and enter your own drivers in there so that everybody's opinion is taken into account. We have definitely more agenda than we can deal with under the current arrangement, and we're going to have to do something to make it work. So please answer the survey, and hopefully by the next teleconference we'll be able to review that and move forward with a possibly revised schedule that will include additional time one way or the other, or a reduced agenda if that's what it comes to. But the initial results are with about six or seven responses that most people seem to feel that a second teleconference per month is probably in order, and they want to keep it on a weekday. But, please add your own opinion and just go from there. Okay, then the third thing is future debates topics. Two were mentioned in the previous survey that I think I should mention in passing. One is one person, and again, I don't know who these people are because all these things are anonymous. One person said he or she would be willing to debate on the affirmative as to whether or not the flat earth movement is a threat to the 9/11 truth movement. Does anybody on the call wish to own that proposal?
I couldn't hear you, Ken. The what was the threat?
The flat earth movement.
Oh.
Yeah. Does anybody on the call wish to own that volunteer and to debate that? Okay, well then
This is Barb. I'm not owning it, but I have some knowledge about that. People need to know.
Well, I know, but that's not what we're trying to do right now. We're trying to see whether or not this is a debate topic that somebody wants to pursue. So apparently nobody's owning that, so we'll just move on to the next one. The next one was somebody offered to debate in the affirmative that call one of that particular proposal. Okay. Well, then those people aren't here or are not owning it up, so we'll just pass that by. And unless there's another proposal for a debate in the future, we can leave this. Is there any other proposal for a debate that anybody would be willing to debate?
Dave Schlesinger.
David, go ahead.
Yeah, the mini debate we're about to have with me, Danny. That would be a bit more extended.
Okay, so you would be willing
somebody
to
other than Andy,
to,
whoever
you would, like to debate, you would like to debate the AE-911 truth policy of denying direct contact with information from their signatories?
Yeah, I mean, there are many related issues, the whole issue of encrusted
bureaucracy. Well, I need a proposition.
Encrusted bureaucracy would be my choice.
What's the proposition? I'm sorry.
AE has become an encrusted bureaucracy, not dedicated to building a loop.
Okay, so AE-911 Truth has become an encrusted bureaucracy that is no longer interested in what?
No longer having as a top priority building a movement to generate a real investigation.
No longer having a top priority of building a movement
to generate a real investigation.
To generate a real investigation of 9/11. Okay. All right. So does anybody on the call wish to answer Dave's challenge to debate that question on a formal basis in the future?
Well, that's what I'm here to do tonight, so I don't know what your procedures are, but that's what I'm here for tonight.
Yeah, I understand that.
Who
this
is that?
That's David Steele, or Andy Steele.
Andy Steele.
Yeah. But this is, that's not what this is about. David is proposing a formal debate on this, which would be a very, much longer thing. And he's saying that he would be willing to take the affirmative position on that if anybody would be willing to debate him on the negative side. Is anybody willing to debate us on the negative side? Well, hearing none, then I guess what we'll do is we'll put that out in the minutes that this has been proposed by David as a topic for debate, and he's willing to take the affirmative, and if anybody's willing to take the negative, we'll have a debate in the future, okay? All right. Thank you, David. All right, so moving along now, we get to our next agenda topic, which would be Robin Corbin's presentation on ground effects for 10 minutes. So, Robin, are you ready?
Yes, I am ready, but I have a slight suggestion. Since the call is sort of so long, and it's 6:45 right, or an hour and 45 minutes now, that, and also, Ken, I was unable to give you a successful link about speeds, which does have a relationship to ground effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally have figured out that link, and I can get that to you, which then you can inform people. So it might be worthwhile tonight to finish or have David and Andy just kind of make their statements a little bit back and forth and then postpone my thing to March.
Fair enough. Okay. So if there's no objection, we'll postpone.
Excuse me, this is Wayne's comment.
March, and that would be very helpful because we're very short on time tonight. Thank you. Robin?
Hello, this is Wayne.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so Robin, can you give us at least a thumbnail sketch of what you're trying to propose? The materials are really vague that you sent. I have no idea even what you're planning to discuss. Can you give us at least a synopsis? Thank you.
Point of order.
Can I just point of order, Ken? I mean, if we're postponing this, we should postpone it, shouldn't we?
Well,
I mean,
if you object to Robin giving a synopsis, then we'll have to take a vote on it, Craig, yes?
I would, because I think it's just something that deserves more than just a quick...
Even if you were limited to a minute to give the synopsis?
Well, no, it's okay, I guess, yeah.
Okay, so we can keep it to a minute, Robin, and just give them a brief description of what you're trying to accomplish, and then we'll postpone it until next week, or next month.
Yes, Ken, I can do that easily in a minute.
Aircraft flight speed as they relate to the aviation events on 9/11 are actually very critical and have contributed to undermining and disemboweling the 9/11 truth community, both at the World Trade Centers and at the Pentagon, and also in a slight fashion in Shanksville. So my goal is to just give people on this teleconference a thumbnail, basically a primer, on the theory of flight and how I think some information has been misrepresented regarding the ground effect, which is a function of speed, aircraft speed at the Pentagon, and then the second largest undermining reality in the 9/11 truth community, as far as I am concerned, which is the impossible speeds position that the pilots of 9/11 truth have posited regarding United 175.
Does that satisfy you there? You have a synopsis there?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
So, with that said, then we'll postpone this issue until the March teleconference, and we'll proceed with the last item on tonight's agenda, other than the announcements, and that would be David's opportunity to protest the current AE-911 truth policy, denying him direct access to contact information from its signatories. David, you have 5 minutes maximum. Go ahead.
Thanks so much. First off, I need to say up front that I still support Richard Gage as running AE. I support AE's narrowness as compared to much of the rest of the movement. I do have 20,000 name list that I've never contacted people I didn't already know, so I have not abused that list. My effort here is designed to help AE. If I can generate enough concern on this call in other ways, if I can't generate enough concern, I will arrange to go to jail at the New York anniversary, preferably a choreographed, non-disruptive scenario. That might be this venue might be the only venue we really have to avoid that CD. I do need to say I met with Richard Gage and Bill Jacoby for a friendly conversation on the Friday night of this St. Pete conference, and I did keep the agreement that I made there. I also had, before that, I had a 2-hour-long conversation, very friendly, with Richard Gage about a week before the St. Pete meeting. A couple of years ago, when I left AE, there were about 20 teams that existed. Now there are about 5. And I was the team-building team leader and was generally the first person most activists who came up to AE spoke to. I used to be able to regularly generate 5 new people for each weekly meeting. The specific concern I have is a new policy generated in late January that no organizer will be allowed to be given a list of petition signers to call, no matter how qualified that organizer is. This is a policy that had existed for many, many years, and the whole history of the weekly conference call is a history of suppression of this right, this big fight that existed for many years where I would be allowed to, as team-building team leader, find somebody who was willing to organize a list for that area, and I would be promised them a list, and then the list would not arrive when it was supposed to, and I would raise my voice, and Richard Gage would much rather fail than have anyone raise their voice. I don't call names, but I do raise my voice. The only people on this call who were on those Thursday calls on a regular basis are Andy, Wayne Costi, Dan Hennen, Dwayne Dietz, John O'Malley, and Tim Michael. The rest of you would be hard for you to understand the perspective here. My parallel question is, why would a donor be offended to be asked to volunteer? That seems to be the assumption that it will hurt the ability to raise money if you have people calling people asking them to volunteer. I mean, they just say, gee, I don't have time, or, you know. There are a lot of good reasons not to volunteer. Richard Day did admit to me a few weeks ago that Kelly David did not, he disobeyed him when he insisted that Wayne Costi be allowed to be given the full list. Wayne was on the board at the time, and the reason Kelly wouldn't give it to him is because Kelly doesn't like Wayne, as if that's a reason for anything. They no longer have a priority of building a movement. Their priority is to look good, to raise money, to pay staff. Various of the subjects that I won't go into now, but I can, is the generation of a physics outreach team, the Chomsky situation from this past November, the Beyond Misinformation excellent book, which was handled. There are two misleading aspects of that promotion. The Army of Presenters has a important misinformation that has been given out, and July 4th leafleting. And I also assume some people would like to know about the suicide of the founder of the legal team after AE was incredibly vicious to her, which is what upset me so much that I threatened to hurt AE, which I never did. And that's why Richard threw me out, and we've always had only good conversations since that time.
Okay, thanks. 5 minutes, please. Thank you. From AE 911 Truth, Andy Steele would like to make a response. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, I just wanted to, first of all, thanks for inviting me on this call, and I'll explain who I am. I'm the Operations and Volunteer Coordinator for AE 911 Truth, and I just want to take advantage of this time to clarify our policy to address any confusion that may be getting on right now. First of all, we are not stopping people from ever having lists again. Now, Kelly David, she's our Chief Operating Officer. She just approved a list for Dave Bureau for Richard's event in Portland that's coming up. We are continuing to work with our volunteers on anything that's related to AE 911 Truth business and any projects that are related to our mission. Now, of course, we have to be careful with any personal information of our supporters that we give out. And want to make sure that the people who, you know, contact others who have signed our petition are doing so in relation to AE 911 Truth work. Because we've always been focused on the science of the building demolitions in New York and avoiding speculation on outside issues. So our list can't be used for gathering people for other issues. All right, so anything not related to AE business is considered third party, and we're not handing over people's information to third parties because that's not what they signed the petition for. All right, they signed because they want a new investigation into the towers, not because of Sandy Hook or GMO or Boston bombing or even necessarily because they think 9/11 was an inside job. I mean, some people are very neutral on that, but they signed because they think that the NIST report was flawed for some reason, you know, for one aspect or another. So we got to respect that. I mean, the fact is, we've been very successful because our approach is a very narrow focus on just the sciences of building demolitions, like I said, and we've been able to appeal to professional people, people who aren't aware of the bigger issues, because we avoid those things. Now, with reference to the 9/11 Truth Action Project, they wanted to grow and expand into other issues, so they became an independent group. Bill Jacoby, who leads it, was very happy with the arrangement that we made with them, and so are people that I'm in contact with from 9/11 TAP Group. And the people from the 9/11 TAP Group, they still come onto the AE conference call, and they talk about what they're doing nearly every week. And I continue to meet with Bill once a week to discuss and plan any mutual projects that we know we have in common. And I continue to send Bill volunteers who are interested in local organizing. I sent them some this week. So So there is actually no problem here. I mean, there's no fire, there's no smoke, other than what Dave is blowing. 80 volunteers are currently getting a lot of work done. They're helping out in projects. They're actually getting outreach done to architects. We're doing something with student chapters of the ASCP, political people. Let's meet with some people later tonight after this. And we're coming up with new volunteer activities all the time. Those actually go to new volunteers that write to us, a whole big list of things that they can help us out with. And that's what we're going to keep on doing with our outreach strategy because it works. Now, Dave mentioned our fundraising efforts earlier. And fundraising is something that every nonprofit's got to do. And if we didn't do it, we wouldn't have things like the booklet that just came out, the Beyond Disinformation that everyone's handing out, or the Building 7 computer model that the University of Alaska is putting together, which is going to completely smash whatever's remaining of the official story. So this is common sense, and it's necessary to keep AE growing and alive, and we're going to continue doing that, too. Our staff works all day on 9/11 Truth. They need to make some money because they can't go to the store when they're hungry and be given free food. And they only make a tiny fraction of what's the worth and making less than most of what people are making at nonprofits. And AE is a controversial group, so, you know, it doesn't really look good on a resume later on if, you know, if they have to move forward. So they're making some big sacrifices working here. And also, too, I want to address, if there's some personal attacks and slanders against AE staff and misrepresentations of how people are, and I don't really think it dignifies much of a response, but, you know, things that have been said about the people here are false and ridiculous, and I wish I could say it's surprising that Dave is behaving this way, but it just reflects a pattern of abuse and antisocial behavior that we stopped tolerating when we let go of him 2 years ago, which a lot of other volunteers seconded. Even the people that Dave is claiming to be advocating for don't support him and what he's doing right now. There are some very dedicated people here. They've proven their commitment to the movement time and time again, even before they came to 9/11 Truth. And, you know, I'm working 18 hours a day, and so, you know, just because of
that. That's 5 minutes. Thank you, and we appreciate your willingness to be here to answer on behalf of 9/11 Truth. Hey, 9/11 Truth. And that ends this segment. We will now move on to our announcement.
I thought you were going to do Q&A. I thought there was going to be a Q&A.
There was if there was time, but there's no time. There are 5 minutes. You took your full 5 minutes, David, and the other, Andy took about full 5 minutes. There's no time left for Q&A. So we'll have to move on. It's we're way over time here, okay? Sorry. Does anybody have any announcements?
I do.
Who's I?
Dave Schlesinger.
David, okay, and who else?
Kat. Barbara.
Kat and Barbara, and who else? Okay, so David, you first. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm interested in seeing who would be interested in working with me in generating an effort to focus on Professor Bazant of Northwestern. I'm actually considering going and holding a banner outside of the building he works in the Chicago area. I assume most of you know who Bazant is.
Can you tell us who he is real quickly, please, David?
Bazant is the person who, the civil engineering professor who finished a peer-reviewed paper 2 days after 9/11 defending the official story. He's written more than one paper.
So this is Wayne?
One moment, Wayne. I'll put you on the last on the list. I'm sorry. Kat? Does anybody want to respond to David's request? Does anybody else want to respond? Would anybody like to volunteer to work with David on?
Not that he would go to Chicago, but he would dialogue with me about the issue.
Yeah. This is Wayne.
Okay, Wayne.
Yeah, I have to make a statement about this. I am actually on, first of all, I've been the person that has been going after the American Society of Civil Engineers, where Bazant has published his papers, and I have
I believe that it is most important to bring the accountability to the institutions such as the American Society of Civil Engineers. I personally don't approve of going to assaulting or bringing people to embarrassment, but on a personal basis. But I'm very much interested in going after the institutions. My assault on Professor Bazant is trying to get the American Society of Civil Engineers to retract four of his papers that have been proven to be not in the scientific interest. That is the sole part of what I'm trying to do, and I think that is the right way to approach this. People in academia have the rights to say anything they want, and of course they certainly have. I really don't think it's appropriate. I think it's appropriate that we need to go after the institutions, and if you'd like to help me on that, that's great. And Dave has helped me on that. He's been out in Phoenix at an ASCE conference that I helped to support him on being out there, handing out flyers very specific to this. Thank you very much.
And I don't assault anybody.
If nobody wants to say anything to respond to David on this, we'll go to Kat.
Okay. I just have a quick announcement for people to please support NewsBud. It's an alternative media network that is being started by Fidel Edmonds, Peter B. Collins, James Corbett, and it will not be funded by foundations. So please go to Kickstarter, just plug in the search NewsBud, and please commit to helping in any way you can financially to the Kickstarter show for NewsBud. Thank you.
Could you spell NewsBud, Kat?
NWSBUD.
Okay.
This is an attempt to create a new news consortium, an alternative news consortium that will give independent alternative news journalists an opportunity to be permanently part of something larger. And so the land is the figurehead. I've personally contributed to it already, but I encourage everybody else to as well. And
not just analysis and talking heads. They want a whole news operation for us,
and
for truth.
Where do people link to contribute? Yeah.
Kickstarter. Go to Kickstarter and search NewsBud, and it's all right there.
Yeah. Go to Kickstarter. The Kickstarter.com, I think it is, or newsbud.org, I can't remember. And then look for NewsBud, and you'll find it, and that will be the opportunity to help them along the way. They have a $900,000+ goal to get started, and they're at 10% right now. They've got about 50 days left in their fundraising, so please help them out if you can. Okay, Barbara, you're next.
It was hard to hear. Ken, did you say 900,000?
It's over 900. Yeah, it's over 900,000. I think they're trying to raise.
So almost $1 million.
Wait a minute. I think that's correct. Am I correct on that, Kat?
What was your question?
What is the goal? Their fundraising goal to get started to get this thing off?
About $1,950,000.
Yeah, 950,000.
Okay, 150 or 900?
900.
Okay, basically $1 million. Okay, all right.
Yeah, pretty close, yeah.
Okay, so am I next, then?
Yep, you're next.
Okay, well, I have a kind of a major announcement. I've made a tentative decision. I took out the petition papers today, to run for Congress in my congressional district, 20th District, California, on a 9/11 truth platform.
Wow. Yes,
you're going to love this. Jimmy Panetta, Leon Panetta's son.
Wow.
So you're going against him?
Jimmy Panetta, yes. He will
That's
be the
great. That's
candidate.
Great. That's great.
Wow.
You can wave as you walk by.
I can wave at what?
Where you can wave at Leon as you stroll by the...
Leon happens to be my neighbor in Carmel Valley, California. I run into him in the mom and pop grocery.
Well, Bobby, that's great.
You're running on an Idaho on the Truth platform. I'm sure that we all wish you the very best, Carmel, and good luck.
I'm not going to be controversial within our movement information. Just what is scientifically absolutely factually proven. That will be enough. And I intend to ask Cynthia, my friend Cynthia McKinney, my soul sister, to come in. And I also intend to ask my 30-year friend Mike Gravel to come in and campaign.
Good for you, Barbara.
So we'll know for sure. All I need, believe it or not, is 40 validated signatures by March 11th. And that's easy to get. I can get a lot more than that.
Barbara, what is
I'll sign.
I couldn't. Somebody should ask the question.
What is the position you're running for, Barbara?
U.S. Congress, 20th District of California.
Oh,
okay. Who holds the seat now?
Sam Farr. I actually ran for Congress as an independent against him in 1994, got more votes per dollar spent than anyone else, and that was a special election, 26 candidates. When Leon Panetta, who was our U.S. representative, left his seat to be President Clinton, Bill Clinton's White House chief of staff. So it opened a special election. I ran for that. The Democrat, Sam Farr, who's a very decent person, has been in the job ever since 1994. And he's announced he's no longer going to run. So the seats opened up for this November.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you, Barbara. Okay. Thank you. Wayne, you next?
I had nothing to add. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you heard you wanted to make an announcement. That's an announcement. Okay. Thank you. All right. So I guess that completes our teleconference for this evening. Thank you all for your cooperation. And we'll see you next. Last Wednesday of March, right here, same time, same place.
Okay, thanks everybody.